I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, I'd rather be called right-wing than incompetent, Dow Constantine. Plus, former Seattle Police Chief Adrian Diaz comes out as gay amid accusations from female staffers that he acted inappropriately.
Why should anyone believe you?
You know, it's absurd, and I haven't had that opportunity to just be able to tell my story.
Plus, the State Court of Appeals just made a ruling in a case that will make it almost impossible for landlords to avoid lengthy eviction proceedings. We'll dive into it. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at UndividedPod.com. Hello, 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 and welcome to Undivided. I'm Brandi Cruz. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. As a journalist, there's one thing you have to avoid. There is one thing that can tank a story, can tank a career faster than almost anything, and that's confirmation bias. Seeking out sources and seeking out information to confirm a bias or a preconceived notion about a story and where you want that story to go. That I see as one of the fundamental mistakes that we see journalists locally and nationally doing. And look, I'm not, again, I don't know how many times I have to say this on the show, I'm not a journalist anymore. I mean, I have still my journalistic tendencies, right? But I'm a political commentator. So I'm not acting as if, you know, from my mountaintop, I'm some lord of journalism. Like, I was in journalism for a long time. I think I was pretty good at it. And I think I tried to do stories in an unbiased way and tried to seek out information that could disprove a story that I was working on. But there is some stuff that's been happening behind the scenes over the past year that we knew about, we talked to people about, but we never pulled the trigger on doing a story about it. And that was because what I saw happening was a lot of confirmation bias going on in the media and other entities that were looking into and investigating this particular story. So I just want to take you back about 8 months before we dive into the top story of the day to let you in on some of what was going on now that it seems to be coming to a head. So about 8 months ago, rumors started to float around about the, at the time, Seattle Police Chief Adrian Diaz. Now, I want you to put aside any opinions you might have about the Seattle Police Department, about Chief Diaz, and whether he was fit for that role. This all had to do with accusations at the time that Chief Diaz, a married man, was sleeping with his chief of staff and was having an affair with a subordinate employee. So these rumors were widespread. I'll tell you, I was getting multiple calls and texts a week about this. Now, I happened to know his chief of staff. And so that was this interesting wrinkle to the story where I knew his chief of staff and I thought, there's no way that she's having an affair with Chief Diaz. That's just fundamentally, I refuse to believe it. But I thought, okay, like, let's poke around. And what I started to realize is that when I would talk or hear from someone about this affair rumor, they were getting their information, all of these sources, they were getting their information from the same place, from the same singular person. And so that's when I realized that there was a fruit of the poisonous tree situation as a journalist. Like, even if, let's say, I'm like, oh, I want those rumors to be true, or I didn't like Chief Diaz or didn't like his chief of staff. And so I was out, trying to gather information from sources. What I started to realize in doing my job to make sure that we were reporting on something factual is that all of these sources seem to have a motive. All of these sources seem to have a vendetta. And all of these sources were getting their information from a singular source, the poisonous tree. And so when those came in, I thought, we're not doing anything on that. That's a manufactured lie by people who have motivations, people who had motivations against the chief of staff, people who had a vendetta against Chief Adrian Diaz because they didn't believe that he belonged in the job, that he had been elevated for reasons like the color of his skin. So there was this old guard faction at SPD who was just out to get him. And I fundamentally believed that at the time. So this was all happening behind the scenes. We talked about it amongst ourselves quite a bit, but we never brought that to you. Now, there are some news outlets who ran with those rumors. Left-leaning news outlets like KUOW, who did a story about, oh, there's these rumors out there that this is happening, without being able to prove any of it. It's because they were seeking confirmation bias. They don't like the police. So how can we do a negative story on the police? Oh, the police chief is having an affair. So we talked to all these people, multiple sources. Yeah, KUOW. I even told them this at the time on Twitter. I said, you know, word of caution, all those sources are getting that information from the same singular source who's making it up out of nothing for a vendetta. So all that was happening behind the scenes. And then, as you know, more recently in the last few weeks, there have been some accusations that have come out publicly against now former Seattle Police Chief Adrian Diaz from female staffers accusing him of sexual harassment, of discrimination on the basis of gender. And so all of that came to a head and Chief Diaz decided he was going to resign. I feel like he was kind of forced out, that Mayor Bruce Harrell felt like these accusations are just too much. They're a distraction. And so they came together and Chief Diaz resigned from his job as chief of police and decided he was going to, they were going to put him in special projects or whatever that is. Sounds like kind of a fast track for him to leave the department. So that brings us to last night on the Jason Rantz show. Our friend Jason Rantz over at KTDH had a pretty bombshell interview with former police chief Adrian Diaz, where he came out as gay. I saw this on, in fact, it was one of our subscribers who tweeted out something about it, and I texted him and I said, are you joking? Is this true? He's like, no, turn on Jason Rantz right now. So I did. So Jason starts this interview by detailing all these accusations about, you know, affairs and women saying that he's sexually harassing them. And that teed Adrian up to come out of the closet for the very first time.
Why should anyone believe you?
You know, it's absurd. And I haven't had that opportunity to just be able to tell my story. It's a story that is struggled with over the last 4 years, that I'm a gay Latino man. And not, you know, it doesn't bother me. It's more of my concern for my kids, because they're going to have to deal with a lot of the struggles that I might not have to deal with.
Yeah. And look, I think if this were just a story about a man realizing, you know, halfway through his life that he's gay, he still has a wife and three kids, like, I don't think that would really be a news story, right? That's, you know, we're in an accepting state, an accepting environment, and I want him to be able to live the life that he's going to be happy living. So good for him. What makes it a story, obviously, are the accusations that, you know, here you have these accusations come out that he's having an affair with the chief of staff, that he's sexually harassing female officers, et cetera, et cetera. And then now he comes out and says, well, no, I wasn't doing those things because I'm gay. So Jason Rantz asked him what I'm sure was a belief among some, that he's like coming out of the closet just to, I don't know, just to like undercut these claims. So here's that.
You know, COVID hit, George Floyd hit. I was then appointed as interim chief. So then that wasn't a good time, because when you're being, you know, up for a job, there's a thought that like, oh, he cried, or he's sensitive, or he's not going to be able to handle the pressures of the work. And I took our department through some of the most difficult times and challenges in our history.
Yeah. So he says, why now? Why wait this long when all these things were mounting and there just wasn't a good time? And he was worried. And I feel bad that he's having to come out in this way, almost this feeling like, well, I've got to do it because all these women are accusing me of sexually harassing them or whatever it is. So he decides now is the time. He comes out as gay. He says that his family, his wife, have known for some time.
You know, kind of worked through some of our challenges. You know, she's known for a long time, and we have different sleeping arrangements, and we've, you know, worked through, you know, how we're going to support the kids. And, you know, that was one of the biggest things for me, was making sure that my kids wake up with both of us. And I think people have to realize that this is kind of your new family. It's your new structure. You know, I can't guarantee that that's the way it's always going to be for us. And I know that that's a struggle for Kelly, is that, you know, she's felt abandoned and rejected. But, you know, I think she understands that she wants me to live who I am. And she's been very supportive of that.
Yeah, and that's part of the story really doesn't matter to me. I mean, how he deals with his personal life and his family and his wife and his kids and all of that. I mean, this is 2024 in America. I mean, this stuff happens where people come out of the closet later in life. Like, that to me is kind of none of our business. I feel like, you know, he was on Jason to talk about this, obviously. So those are some of the questions that he came up. But here is the underlying debate that's happening on social media right now. And some left-wing bloggers who hate the cops are like, basically suggesting Adrian Diaz came out of the closet so that he wouldn't lose these lawsuits, which makes no sense in the world. I mean, you hear that, man. So you're really sitting there saying a grown man who's married with three kids is going to go on a talk show and say he's gay when he's really not and upend his life, personal and professional and all of that, just because some female officers are making a claim against him in the department that he's not even going to be personally liable for? That makes no sense, Erica Barnett with Publicola. I mean, that's it's so interesting. Like, these left-wing bloggers who are like, oh, you know, equality and gay rights and all this, but screw you, Adrian Diaz, stop lying and saying you're gay just to get out of things. It's like, these people are mental. That's like a mental disorder. It's wild to me. So I just refuse to believe that someone would, in his position, just make up that he's gay to get out of accusations that females are saying that he sexually harassed them or was having an affair with the chief of staff or something. That just is stupid. And also, him coming out as gay doesn't make the claims go away. It's not like, you know, when this turns into a lawsuit, the judge is going to be like, yeah, but he's gay, so he definitely didn't sexually harass anyone. Gay people can sexually harass women. And he certainly knows that. He just wanted to add this context to it. And he did say that when these accusations started to come out, he told the mayor. Jason's the first person he told. His wife knew, and he says he told the mayor he was gay.
And so having that support from the mayor was really crucial. You know, for me, as I started to deal with some more challenges, you know, it was like every 2 weeks there was another story. Every 2 weeks there was another story. And I knew that this was a very, you know, targeted effort. And so that's where I started to have a lot of concerns about, you know, because I knew all the validity of this was just completely nonsense, you know, and that's the struggle that you deal with.
So he says that all this was targeted, that these accusations were part of a targeted effort to get him to be fired or be forced to resign or whatever it is. And so Jason asked him, okay, well, what would the rationale for that be?
Why would there be a concerted effort against you?
You know, I think that, you know, I think people want their own opportunities. And I was given the opportunity to serve as a chief. And it's not an easy job. And I think there's a lot of scrutiny and a lot of heartache in it. And no one should want this job in the sense of there's just all eyes are on you. But I think sometimes, you know, people feel like they deserve that opportunity. And I get it. Like, I don't question people feeling like they, you know, want that opportunity.
Yeah. So he's suggesting maybe for career advancement. And I've already said, I have said that there are a lot of people in the department, in the rank and file, sort of the old guard of SPD who never wanted him to get that job, were very angsty. I mean, I'm very well sourced within SPD. They were very mad he got that job. They felt like he got it because of the color of his skin, that he was essentially a diversity hire. He didn't have the type of experience that Carmen Best, for instance, had. She'd done so many different jobs in the department, earned a lot of trust and respect, and he was just sort of elevated. So, you know, I understand them having those problems with him. What I can't understand is manufacturing rumors about an affair, or if they are manufactured, you know, trying to go after him and saying that he was horrible to women and sexually harassed women, etc. Now, this was interesting. I just wanted to play this because it sort of foreshadows what might be to come. Jason asked him if he was explicitly told by anyone with the city not to come out of the closet.
Were you ever told by anyone in the administration, in the mayor's office, not to come out?
You know, that'll be something that will be discussed at a later time. But, you know, I think for me and the community, you know, as I've talked to a lot of members of the community, and, you know, I've been really had just an immense amount of support. And as with anything, I'm sure that, you know, people will try to, you know, de-gay you or un-gay you, you know, to try and say that doesn't fit their narrative, and or they'll try to slap at you, and that's just part of this process. And I
But you did get some resistance.
Yes. But right now for me is about trying to make sure that I move forward, and I move forward for the community.
So suggesting that maybe, I don't know, he's going to file suit or something, and somebody told him not to come out of the closet, which I think is interesting in Seattle in 2024. Like, why would anyone be opposed to someone coming out as gay if they're gay? Now, the reaction to this has all been so fascinating to me to watch, because I see a man who I think is being honest. I think that he is gay, and he didn't previously want to come out of the closet, had a wife and kids and a very public-facing job. I have never been in that position, but I imagine that coming out as gay in those circumstances would be very difficult. But now he feels compelled to, because he feels like it undercuts the claims being made against him by women. So, but the reaction has been really interesting. A lot of people suggesting that this is some sort of advantageous timing for him, or he's just completely manufacturing it. And even in our own live chat right now, Sergeant Pickles, I do perhaps understand not wanting to come out to save his wife and kids from ridicule, but even so, why say it now? Matt, Kevin Spacey pulled the gay card when he got caught. I believe he's telling the truth. I also believe the timing is 100% to get sympathy in the face of results, in the face of lawsuits. It's interesting. A lot of stuff like that. I asked you guys in our daily subscriber show poll today, do you think the revelation that Diaz is gay undermines the accusations against him? So is it sort of, for lack of a better word, advantageous for him to come out as gay with these accusations looming? The vast majority of you are saying no, that just because he's gay doesn't mean that it's going to make the claims against him go away. And I tend to agree. I mean, I have a lot of gay friends. Gay friends sexually harass women all the time. I mean, in a joking way, right? But if you don't know someone is gay, I'm just shooting from the hip here. I don't know if this is going to be offensive. But do you know what I mean, Nicole? I mean, like, if you didn't know that some of my guy friends are gay, and they're sort of like, oh, you know, making, like gay guys do, making comments about your appearance and your dress and all this stuff.
Right.
You could take that, if you didn't know they were gay, you could take that as sexual harassment.
I suppose. But if you knew they're gay, they're like, pretty clear with their intent with it. Yeah. And I think, I think these people are looking for something to report on him. And so I don't think it's necessarily, I don't know that he is in that way jokey because he's still like, you know, becoming gay, I guess. He's his moving into this personality that is a gay man. And so I don't know that that's what he's probably accustomed to, but I get what you're saying.
But I'm not,
your friends are extremely that way.
Yes, like touchy-feely. And I'm not saying that all gay men are flamboyant and talk about women's appearances and stuff, but I have a couple friends who, if you did not know they were gay, you'd be like, get away from me.
But
like,
you'd know they were gay.
Stop talking about my chest and my all this stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that's what happened here. And even so, he's the chief of police. So if he was making comments like that to subordinate female officers, he probably shouldn't have, right? Mm-hmm. But I this whole thing is just interesting. It's like people's questioning his motives. And it's like, at some point, I do believe he's actually gay, and so he's probably looking at when should I come out, and that seems like a pretty good time. I probably would have too if I were facing accusations from women, and like people have been saying for a year plus that I'm having an affair with my chief of staff.
And you've already lost your job.
And you're like, you just want to scream like, hey, I'm gay. Like, I'm not having sex with my chief of staff. So it's just wild. A few more of the comments. Sally said, is his coming out gay like men claiming to be women so they can be housed in a women's prison? I don't see the advantage there. Jackie says, no, absolutely not. It doesn't undercut the claims against him. But knowing the way our local court systems work, I would be surprised if his revelation doesn't ruin her case when and if it gets to that level. Chris says, Seattle swings between being a dumpster fire and a soap opera. Yeah, it's like a soap opera about a dumpster fire would be the city of Seattle. So look, I sympathize with Adrian. Adrian has never been anything but kind to me and nice to us. He's a friend of the show. I have no reason to believe he's making up that he's gay. I feel bad for him that he felt compelled, given everything going on, to almost like a forced outing. And I certainly, sympathize with how challenging it might be for his family, but all of that is personal. The only thing that really is any of our business is how, if at all, it impacts the ongoing claims against the city of Seattle. So I'm sure that that is not the last that we're going to hear about that story. Okay, Dow Constantine, what a whiner. Oh, Dow, I just had to do a follow-up today. So we played on the show last week and again yesterday, and this clip has been viewed millions of times on social media. Dow Constantine in his state of the county address claiming that homelessness is simply about a lack of available housing.
One widely held belief is that behavioral health issues like untreated mental health or substance use disorders are root causes of the homelessness crisis that we see all around us. This is wrong. University of Washington researcher Greg Colburn has shown that the cause of the homelessness phenomenon is not individual challenges, but a housing market failure.
Yeah, that's just not true. You know, we talked on the show about, you know, dissecting that argument from him, but the point I made was even if it is a housing failure, you've been the King County executive for 15 years. The same party has been in control in our state for 40 years. So who should bear the blame there if it is a housing failure, which it's not, obviously. So Dow Constantine apparently did not like my commentary on his ridiculous state of the county address. And he took to his personal Facebook page and said, right-wing media seems to be losing its collective ever-loving mind that I said the facts about housing and homelessness out loud. They really don't like facts that contradict their narrative of blame and shame. But knowing the facts is essential to solving the problem. Here's the source. It's a good read if you have the time. It's in the title. Homelessness is a housing problem. Yeah, just because this dude named his book Homelessness is a Housing Problem doesn't mean that's true. Like, it doesn't mean that's true. I also, oh my God, I could pick apart just that paragraph he wrote. I love that he's like, right-wing media. You can say my name, Dow. It's fine. You'd probably get more clicks if you said my name. But I'd rather be right-wing than incredibly incompetent. The other thing he says about they're losing their ever-loving mind that I said the facts about homelessness out loud. And that's what really not only struck me, because I know it's not factually accurate. I mean, we had on multiple guests on Sunday's show about what they see with their own eyes, people who have been there on the streets. But my friend Ari Hoffman with KVI reminded me of something. And thank you, Ari, for doing that. But when Dow gets on this tirade and says, they're mad, I said the facts about housing and homelessness out loud. This is not a drug or mental health crisis. How dare right-wing Brandy say that? This is a housing crisis. What's interesting is Dow Constantine is contradicting himself. Let's go back to 2018 when King County filed a lawsuit against Big Pharma, shall we? So in 2018, in this lawsuit against Purdue Pharma and some other big suppliers who were being accused of contributing to the heroin crisis that we found ourselves in at the time, that has since transformed into a fentanyl crisis. But at this time in 2018 and the years prior to that, we were dealing with a full-blown heroin crisis that was a result of, you know, it was the opioid epidemic, a result of overprescription of pain pills and things like that. So at the time, 2018, King County v. Purdue Pharma, what did they say in the lawsuit? The opioid epidemic has contributed significantly to the homeless crisis in King County. Wow, you don't say. That's interesting. So in King County's own lawsuit, when they were seeking a big payout from Big Pharma, then homelessness was a drug issue. Oh, if we can get money, homelessness is a drug issue. We'll tell the truth about it now. Fast forward now. Oh, it's not a drug issue. That's wrong. It's a housing issue. Let me read more from this lawsuit. Again, this is King County. One particularly visible effect of the opioid epidemic in King County is the growing homeless population. That's so fascinating. Wow. It's as if I wrote this. Homelessness has become a persistent problem in the county. The 2016 King County one-night count found that 4,500 of our neighbors in King County were without shelter that year, a 19% increase over 2015. Although the causes of homelessness are multifaceted and complex, substance abuse is both a contributing cause and result of homelessness. The dramatic rise in homelessness in King County is due in part to the opioid epidemic. Some estimates suggest that the majority of the homeless population is addicted to or uses opioids. Prescription opioids have not only helped to fuel the homeless crisis, but have also made it immeasurably more difficult for the county to address. Gosh, this is really interesting stuff. So in 2018, when they want to get money from Big Pharma, the homelessness crisis is being driven by substance abuse. The vast majority of people in homelessness are addicted to drugs. And then you fast forward to now when they're like, oh, we already squeezed Big Pharma for all the money we can get out of them. So now let's squeeze the taxpayers to get money from them for affordable housing so we can continue to get funds rolling in for our cronies. And let's call Brandy right wing for saying the exact same freaking thing we said in a 2018 lawsuit. Fascinating stuff, isn't it? Wow. They also included in this lawsuit pictures, actual photo evidence of homeless encampments littered with needles. Said not only this from the lawsuit. Oh, God, this stuff is good. It's so they make it so easy on us, right? To point out their absolute lies. Not only are there more encampments, but they have become much larger. As the photograph below illustrates, the homeless encampments in county parks can be enormous. The increased frequency and intensity of homelessness in county parks presents a myriad of issues. First, nearly every encampment in King County Parks has used syringes, which present dangers to all who use the parks. Let's see, I just got to keep going here because this is entertaining me. More pictures of homeless encampments. Unfortunately, as King County's data shows and the near ubiquitous presence of heroin syringes at homeless encampments illustrate, many of the homeless people in these encampments are using opioids. It's so fascinating to me how just 6 years ago they drew this very straight line between drug addiction and homelessness. And now that line's like housing. It's crazy. And I'm the right wing crazy one, right? And even the city of Seattle v. Purdue Pharma. Remember, it wasn't just King County. The state of Washington sued the pharmaceutical companies. Multiple cities, including the city of Everett and the city of Seattle, sued Purdue Pharma and other pharmaceutical companies. And the city of Seattle, in their lawsuit, said the exact same thing. We pulled that back up. Seattle has seen its homeless population swell. A 19% increase over 2015. Researchers estimate that over 50% of people with opioid addictions in Seattle are homeless. And Seattle's navigation team, composed of outreach workers and police officers specifically trained to interface with the homeless population, estimate that 80% of the homeless individuals they encounter in challenging encampments have substance abuse disorders. It also talks about how much the drug epidemic is costing them when it comes to it becoming a homeless crisis. Seattle spent $53 million to address the homelessness emergency in 2016, and more than $60 million is budgeted for 2017 and 2018. Included in these sums are millions of dollars for outreach and counseling services designed to help people get into housing, including shelters, improved encampments, and traditional housing. Ba-ba-ba-da-da. So you get it. It's like, first of all, these numbers are hilarious, actually. Reading back their numbers from 2018 from these lawsuits against Big Pharma, suggesting that, oh, we've got a crisis on our hands, the numbers have doubled since then. So they thought it was a crisis then. 4,500 people in King County? That's nothing now. That's nothing now. We talk about the numbers all the time. It's ballooned. So they got all this money from Big Pharma. What'd they do with it? Because at the time they said, hey, Big Pharma, you're to blame for the homelessness crisis. Drug addiction is contributing to that crisis in a major way. So we want millions and millions and millions of dollars, and we're going to fight this crisis tooth and nail, and therefore we're going to deal with homelessness. Where'd the money go? What'd you do with the money? Homelessness and drug addiction are both worse off now than they were then. So they don't, first of all, the absolute incompetence is infuriating. I can laugh at it, right? Like, Dow Constantine saying one thing now and it's on paper in black and white saying another thing 6 years ago, yet he's attacking me for saying exactly what they said 6 years ago. But think of the dereliction of duty here. Think of the incompetence. I told Dow Constantine on Twitter today, I was like, you need to look in a mirror and really ask yourself if your constituents would be better served by someone else. You have presided over an immense increase in homelessness, an immense spike in addiction. Not, you know, we could get into a million other things like crime, etc. And you have the audacity to say in a Facebook post that right-wing media like me is losing its collective mind, that you said the truth and we don't like facts that contradict their narrative of blame and shame. You need to be blamed and shamed. More media need to blame and shame you. The fact that you don't feel an immense amount of shame shows that you're a narcissist. The fact that you can't look back at what you said about the homeless crisis 6 years ago and how it contradicts what you're saying today, and that you can't see how the numbers have spiked, how the number of people dying has spiked. Like, if you don't, you should feel far more shame than I could ever make you feel. You should feel shame on your own without the media having to blame and shame you. And the fact that you feel no shame, Bob Ferguson feels no shame, Jay Inslee feels no shame, the Democrats who got us into this mess and now lie about what it's going to take to get us out of this mess. The fact that none of them feel shame about what has happened in this state over the past 10 years is a perfect illustration of why they and people like them of their political ideology don't belong within 500 miles of decision-making in this state, in Seattle, and in King County. Wild stuff. So call me right-wing. Much rather be right-wing than absolutely useless and incompetent. All right, one more story in our lead here today. Bob Ferguson's publicity stunt that he is planning to pull if he's elected governor really shows, again, why he shouldn't be governor. But so we know that we have a broken mental health system in Washington state. Under Governor Jay Inslee, our state's largest psychiatric hospital lost its federal accreditation. It's a disaster. We know this. We see it happening on our streets. You know, there's the combination of drug abuse and mental illness, some people who are suffering with both. And then you have individuals who are in and out of our criminal justice system. But because they're mentally ill, they're never truly held accountable and the public's never truly protected from them in a meaningful way. So Bob Ferguson has a plan, though, to deal with all of that. He is going to deal with this absolutely dysfunctional mental health system that isn't helping anyone, that is putting the public in danger. You know what his plan is? It's a great one. I mean, wow, someone should have thought of this sooner. If he's elected governor, he is going to move his office to Western State Hospital for a full week. For a full week. Wow, this man is impressive. Just the way he thinks, totally out of the box. What a stand-up guy. He says, today I released my plan to build the best behavioral health, mental health, and substance abuse support system in the country. Fewer than half of individuals with a mental health disorder in Washington are getting proper treatment. As governor, I will ensure our treatment and response match the scale of the crisis. We must improve access and decrease wait times for Washington's behavioral health programs. I will appoint the first ever statewide mental health director to implement reforms and coordinate a fragmented behavioral health system. We'll intervene in today's crisis and prevent tomorrow's crisis. Read my comprehensive plan. And he had said, I'm going to move my office. I'm going to move my office to Western State for a full week as part of this. Like, what is that going to do? Just go visit. It's okay. Like, I'm all for you going to Western State and seeing things firsthand. That's fine. But there's no need to move your office there for a week. It's not going to do anything at all. It's just a publicity stunt. But also, when he says that he is going to build, he has a plan to build the best behavioral health system in the country. Okay, where were you when our system got so bad that, again, Western State lost its federal certification? You were the state's chief law enforcer. Certainly, if there were people not doing what needed to be done, you as an independently elected official could have taken action. Could you have not? You could have said something. Could you have not? As a member of the Democratic Party, you could have said something. Could you have not? If you had ideas to build the best behavioral health system in the country for all this time that you've been in office while people are suffering and dying and while mentally ill people are committing crimes over and over again on our streets, don't you think you should have brought that forth? Or were you saving those ideas, holding them close to the vest so that when you ran for governor, you could unveil them then while people died and suffered? I find it hard to believe that if you have truly a plan to build the best behavioral health system in the country, that that's something that you just, what, came up with in a month's time? That you hadn't thought about it before while you were the attorney general? I also wonder what that would look like under Bob Ferguson, building the best behavioral health system in the country, where you enhance access to mental health care, prevent and early intervention, strengthen treatment and recovery support, just do a better job helping people who are in crisis. like your office when a developmentally disabled woman in an adult family home in Kent was being neglected by DSHS, and one of the documents that your office kept back from discovery was a document where a state employee case manager appeared to laugh at reports that the woman was being severely neglected by writing LOL in the emails. Remember withholding that email from discovery? So you can tell me that you're going to create a system that's going to care for people who are mentally ill or disabled or suffering from addiction. It's going to be the best in the country. Yet you can't even do what's right when in a singular case of a developmentally disabled woman whose state employees are laughing at, even though she's being severely neglected. Yeah, I have a lot of faith in Bob Ferguson to build a state-of-the-art behavioral health system. But hey, if he stays there for a week, I mean, he can't not fix it, right? A week?
Or at least get some pointers.
Yeah, I mean, a week's time there, we'll have a mental health system back on track in no time at all. Thanks, Bob, for the great ideas. All right, if you're in the market to sell your home at some point in 2024, I suggest calling our friend Wes Jones of sellwithwes.com. Wes has been a real estate agent in this market for a really long time. When our friends Bryce and Carla, fans of Undivided, decided to sell their home in Bellevue and move to sunny Florida for retirement, they reached out to Wes and they were very happy with the results.
I'm just very detail-oriented and never put down our property because you could hear I-90 from our property and it wasn't the most feng shui, yummy piece of property, and our furniture never showed our house well, our own personal furniture, but he was like, oh yeah, he could see in his mind, this will show after the paint and the staging, this will be a premium property. He could see that, and he didn't let us feel like it was a subpar home the way it was.
Yeah, and they sold their home in 7 days over list price, and now they're living their lives in sunny Florida. So if you're in the market to sell your home, contact our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, we talk on the show every Tuesday about what's happening with landlord-tenant laws in Washington State. Complete disaster leading to insane cases of squatting, tenants who aren't paying rent for years on end, and then they get a taxpayer-funded check to cover their back rent, and then they just continue to keep squatting. And the laws have done this. The laws absolutely favor even the worst of the worst tenants, even clearly egregious examples of people who are milking the system and milking taxpayers. Well, this week, there was a court ruling, the Washington State Court of Appeals, that, believe it or not, is about to make all of that even worse. This segment is brought to you in partnership with the Rental Housing Association of Washington. If you're a landlord and a housing provider in Washington State, RHA is your best bet to help you avoid some of the disastrous situations like the ones that we talk about on this show. So visit them, rhawa.org. So joining us in our segment today is Chris Cutting. He is the vice president with RHA, and he's joining us to talk about this case. It is Princeton Properties Management versus the Allens, the Allen family. So oftentimes in these really severe cases, what you see are landlords try to work with them. Like, let's enter into an agreement, whether it's back rent, a payment plan, try to get you caught up, or try to help you clean up the property or whatever it is, so we don't have to move into some full-blown eviction proceedings that, as we know, can languish on for years and years. So what this court hearing, what this court ruling determined is that those agreements are not lawful. That you can't just have a landlord enter into some sort of agreement with a tenant to move forward, because the tenant, that would involve the tenant giving up some of the protections that they have under the law. So I'll let Chris Cutting explain the case a little more, but essentially what this could mean is it could prevent landlords from trying to avoid lengthy eviction processes. Chris, welcome to Undivided.
Thanks very much, Brandy. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so what's your area of expertise, would you say?
So I'm an attorney here in Washington, and I practice landlord and tenant relationships, really focusing on and trying to avoid as well as resolve disputes between property owners and managers of rental property and the tenants that occupy those properties.
Yeah, avoiding disputes, that's the goal, right? Then we get into these crazy situations that are hard to dig out of. So we're talking about a specific case today. Give people the bullet points of what this case was about.
Yeah, so Brandy asked me to come in today to talk a little bit about Princeton versus Allen. This is a Court of Appeals decision that came out last week. It involved a residential eviction for some pretty significant behavioral issues at a rental property. The landlord and the tenant decided to settle that lawsuit rather than go to court, rather than let a judge or a jury decide what should happen. And after the tenant failed to follow the terms of the settlement agreement that they entered into, they challenged the agreement as being invalid in violation of a law that was passed a few years ago. The court ultimately decided that was correct, that the tenant was not allowed to make the settlement agreement that she had chosen to make, and prevented it from being enforced.
Talk about so in this situation, we deal with, and we've been talking about a lot of different issues that pop up in the landlord-tenant relationship. So you said significant behavioral issues. So what was the problem here?
In this particular case, the plaintiff described the tenant as having a unit that was excessively cluttered with garbage and debris, had a lot of miscellaneous personal items, and was blocking safe ingress and egress.
So like a hoarder situation?
I don't know that I would say it quite that way, but again, talking about how the housing provider described it, they said that it created an extreme health hazard to the property and to surrounding residents.
Gotcha. So what is the lesson here, I guess, for housing providers?
Well, the court gives us a very sweeping opinion here that says housing providers, when they're making agreements with tenants, that the tenant doesn't have the ability to waive any of the rights that they're afforded by statute. And that's a core part of when we're trying to resolve disputes. That's a core part of how we do that is the housing provider gives up something maybe that they could do, the tenant gives up something that they could do, and both parties come out better off or believing they're better off because of that agreement. And this says that half of that equation, the resident side of that equation, isn't allowed to make those kind of agreements even if they want to.
Wow, this is interesting. So it is pretty sweeping. So we're talking about the Residential Landlord-Tenant Act of 1973 and basically the rights that affords a tenant. They can't just bargain it away to get rid of a dispute. So this sounds like it fundamentally undercuts the ability of housing providers to try to resolve a dispute they're having with a tenant without going down a legal path.
It really does. In my practice, the overwhelming majority of cases that my office handles resolve through some sort of agreement. That could be as simple as giving the resident a little bit of extra time to get rental assistance, entering into some kind of payment plan. But the core of those agreements is that the housing provider, my client, is doing something that they're not required by law to do. And in exchange, they ask the resident to do something like that as well. And this type of law, this decision really denies residents that agency to make those kind of agreements when they want to.
Yeah, that's wild. So, I mean, to me, if you're looking at, in theory, it's about protecting tenant rights, but it robs the tenant of the ability to resolve something short of like going into a full-blown eviction proceeding. So I guess how is that helping the tenant?
That's exactly right. It certainly, I believe, the goal of the legislature was to protect those residents. But with the fact that we fund attorneys for every resident facing the threat of eviction now in Washington, the residents in this case and the residents in, pretty close to 100% of cases that I handle, they have an attorney. And that attorney looks out for their rights, make sure they're not doing something that's improvident unless they have that informed consent. They really know what they're doing. And this law takes that ability away from residents. It takes that tool away from their advocates, as well as from housing providers who are trying to come up with a creative way to keep somebody housed.
So you're saying, this is crazy. So you're saying that even because of this decision, that even if you have a tenant who has representation and they are fully informed and knowledgeable about what the agreement they're entering into with the landlord to resolve whatever dispute they're having, fully informed about it, they cannot make that decision for themselves.
That's exactly right. Even with an attorney, they're not able to enter into this kind of agreement. And there may have been times in the state, even in the relatively recent history, where there was a need for this kind of rule, at least in part in some areas, but it's really not the case now because at state expense, every tenant who wants one gets a free attorney.
Yeah, because I get it if you're a tenant and you're sort of duped into, agreeing to something you didn't really fully understand and giving some of your rights and protections away. But you make a good point about, like, they all have free attorneys if they want them that can look over this stuff. So what's the long-term implications of this? We're already in this crazy environment for housing providers and tenants. We've got a massive eviction backlog. If they can't strike deals with each other to work things out, what's the long-term impact there on our system?
Well, Brandy, all those problems that you just described, they're going to get much worse. As I mentioned, the overwhelming majority of cases that I handle resolve in some way before a court has to make that final decision. And if this takes away the core tools that we use to get those kinds of resolutions, I mean, half or more of the time, all those cases have to go to court. They have to take up time with a judge, with court staff. They have to consume more time of both the housing providers and the tenants' attorneys. And it's just going to make all those congestion problems, that volume, that much worse.
Wow. Is there any means to appeal again, to take this to a higher court?
I have spoken briefly with the housing provider's attorney in this case, and they're certainly considering that option. The next review would be by the Washington State Supreme Court. That court gets to choose what cases they take based on all those requests they receive. So one of the two parties here would have to be the housing provider, because the tenant did win the case. The housing provider would have to choose to appeal, and our Supreme Court would have to choose to take that case.
Yeah, and I'm not sure the result would be any different in the Washington State Supreme Court. But this is really interesting. Chris, thank you so much for joining us and for explaining this case, and I guess we'll see what happens from here.
It was great talking with you, Brandy. Thanks for getting out word about this.
Yeah, that's absolutely wild. So you can't just have a gentleman's agreement, essentially, like, hey, we don't want to kick you out. We don't want to go through eviction proceedings. So let's work with you, do something we don't even have to do under law, work with you to try to get caught up on rent or clean up the property or whatever it is. So now the State Court of Appeals is saying, no, you can't do that, because the tenant really can't sign something like that. They might be giving up in the process some of their rights, and they're just too dumb to understand what that would do. So you just can't do it. So now all these are what? Going to have to wait in the massive eviction backlog and be worked out that way? How is that better for the tenant? Certainly not better for the housing provider, but we already know the state doesn't care about landlords. But it's not better for the tenant either. So they can't strike a deal to stay. So now it's like, okay, well, I guess I'll just be evicted. Help me make sense of it. It doesn't make any sense. This situation, this crisis is going to get much worse before it gets better, unfortunately. And I don't know what it's going to take to make it better. I do know, though, if you're a landlord in the state of Washington, sign up to become a member of the Rental Housing Association of Washington today, rhawa.org, rhawa.org. Their membership dues are like $260 a year, and they can help. And their goal is to try to help housing providers avoid situations like the ones that we talk about on our show, or give them tools and resources if you find yourself in just such a situation, to try to rectify it as quickly as possible. So rhawa.org. All right, moving on to our segment, Unbelievable. It's here. It's back. It's back. The media once again is telling us to mask up. Let's talk about it. Boop. You know, I can make this segment 5 seconds long. The media is telling you to mask up again. No.
Don't do it.
And that has been Unbelievable for today. No, don't tell them to. I don't care if people do it.
I know. I don't care. Except for.
Don't
I
care.
It did really bother me. I feel this weird rage when I see people in their cars. I saw this lady driving a pink Tesla with a mask on all by herself in the car.
God, I just. It's not rage. I'm just like, oh, that's sad.
No, but it's actually rage. It's not because she's wearing the mask, but because I think she's been fooled to that extent. Yeah. And I am so angry with how all the people that have supported this nonsense that we've given to people, and they've taken it and changed their lives.
Yeah. And like, worse. You know, never turning back, I guess. And you know, it's true that in some, you know, in Japan, for instance, like mask wearing is pretty common and it has been long before COVID. That's fine. Mm-hmm. But like, if you don't have a reason for it, I just don't get it. But if you want it, look, wear a mask in your car, wear a mask in the shower, wear a mask while you sleep. I just don't care. I'm going to laugh at you if I see it internally. I'm going to laugh on the inside. I'm going to probably roll my eyes. Then I'm going to move on with my life. But the media really didn't learn any lessons. The media has not learned any lessons. And one of the things that I have said on the show before I get to the Seattle Times article, trying to fearmonger again, is had we had, you know, one of the concerns I have is that we're going to have a pandemic or something that really is as deadly as they made us believe COVID was, or as, you know, dangerous to people across the health spectrum, you know, not people who are just clinically obese or have comorbidities or something, but for everyone, right? And I'm worried that if we get into a situation like that, because of how COVID was handled, you have half the population that's going to be like, kick rocks. And then we're going to really be in a serious situation because they've lost all confidence in public health officials. And so that's why no mea culpa from public health officials is dangerous. And from politicians like Jay Inslee and Dow Constantine and all the politicians who forced these mandates on us and who, you know, made us so fearful that we didn't see our dying loved ones, et cetera, et cetera. If they were willing to come out and say, hey, we went a little overboard, can you forgive us? I feel like it would do more to get people the next time around to buy in, knowing that there was a recognition that things had gone too far. And then the media. Like, there's never been a mea culpa from the media. I've given a mea culpa. I have apologized publicly multiple times for the extent to which I contributed to the hysteria in early 2020. And I do think for six solid months, I contributed to the hysteria on the news. And then I woke up and I was like, wait a second. And so I've been trying to redeem myself. But the media needs to have a mea culpa for things that it got wrong, and it hasn't. So now here you have the Seattle Times. Summer COVID surge approaches in Seattle area as travel season begins. So it's not even that, wait a second, where's the surge? Summer COVID surge approaches. Where is that? So you're just guessing that a summer COVID surge is going to happen?
Oh, yeah. I guess so.
What if it doesn't? It's wild. A summer COVID surge is on its way through Seattle and the region. Infection rates and emergency department visits in King County have been rising since the end of April. Okay, so they're saying this is going up, causing some concern among doctors and public health officials as travel season picks up and people begin gathering more frequently. Quote, this is the time when people should start taking precautions, said Dr. Eric Chow, King County's chief of communicable diseases. I don't know how high this peak is going to be, when it's going to peak, but taking precautions now is the best way for people to be able to mitigate the complications related to COVID. They go on to say state COVID emergency department visits have also gradually increased since the end of April, though at a slightly slower rate, jumping from about 0.5% to 1% of total emergency department visits. Statewide death rates have remained low for months, though more than 400 people in Washington have died from the virus since January. Another update on COVID vaccines will likely come out later this year as scientists tackle ways to keep Americans safe during the upcoming seasons. But before these shots become available, public health officials are pushing people to get the most updated immunizations already on the market. Take those precautions before heading off on vacation and consider wearing a mask while in airports or on planes, Chow said. Still no nuance.
No, and get vaxxed and then get vaxxed again this year?
Still no nuance to, hey, you know, if you've got comorbidities, if you're very old, if you're heavy, if you've got these underlying health conditions, but, you know, if you're a healthy person, you've been fine, go about your life and do your thing. Still no nuance. It's still the world is burning down. Mm-hmm. Like 0.5% of emergency room visits. And by the way, they don't say whether there was. Remember during the pandemic?
Yes.
A COVID emergency room visit could have been for a broken arm and then someone tests positive for COVID-19. So that's another area of trust that we have completely lost, which is it a COVID death or is it a death from something else and someone happened to have COVID? Is it a COVID emergency room visit? Or did they come in there because they got shot in the face and then you tested them and they tested positive for COVID? All of these things, because of the way that you reported on these things, Seattle Times and other outlets, because of the failures for the 4 years of the pandemic, you now have to provide additional context. You now have to provide, you should, you're not going to, but I think you should have to, provide additional context so we know that you're not messing with us. And what I mean by that is when you say that emergency room visits involving COVID have jumped from 0.5% to 1% of total emergency room visits, you need to clarify, is that people who came in for COVID-19 or is it people who came in for something else? You have to clarify because we don't trust you anymore. And again, when you talk about more than 400 people in Washington have died from the virus since January, because we don't trust you anymore because of how it was reported previously, you need to now tell us how many of those people only died from COVID-19 or died from something else and had COVID-19 or from a complication because they had COVID-19 as an underlying issue. And then how many of those people had comorbidities? How many of those people were particularly susceptible to a respiratory virus, et cetera? You don't, we're not giving you the grace anymore of being able to report on things with such a lack of granular data because of how much incorrect reporting, misrepresentation you shoved down our throats for 4 years. And that I shoved down your throats for a mere 6 months, which I apologize for. All right, unbelievable, unbelievable. Okay, I have encouraged you guys to take the First Mark challenge because it could save you money. And who doesn't want to save money? Our friend Ben Bailey and his wife Leslie took the First Mark challenge, went through their insurance, their current insurance with First Mark. First Mark went out, shopped its carriers for them, ended up saving them $1,500 a year.
You know, it's good to, just like you would go in for an annual physical with your primary care physician. You know, you may not have anything wrong, but it's good just to kind of have that, you know, annual check-in. And I think that's what First Mark, you know, the service and the value that they really provide is it helps. It helps you have an understanding of your coverage.
Yeah, and that's always a good thing because insurance can be confusing. And if you're going out there and trying to get all the insurance you need on your own, do you really know if you have the best policies? Do you really know if you have the best price for those policies? First Mark Insurance can help you with that. The very best thing is the First Mark challenge costs nothing, and you never pay First Mark for its services. So you have this wonderful local insurance broker that's been doing this for a long time, and you never pay them a dime. So firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. Take the First Mark challenge today. All right, let's get to at least one national story. Why not? It was so funny. We did one national story on the show the other day, and one of my Twitter trolls was like, stop covering national stories, Brandy. You're never going to make it big. Just give up. I was like, we're not trying to be a national show. But occasionally there are national stories that are just too good to not cover. Rude, right? Karine Jean-Pierre. So we have shown you, Nicole, are these two clips of Karine Jean-Pierre or is there one a clip of the button? Two. Okay. So Karine Jean-Pierre, first of all, she's just a liar. It's just insane to me. I get it that if you're in that job as press secretary for the president, you're a mouthpiece for the president. And it's not uncommon. I mean, for years, White House press secretaries have tried to spin things, you know, in the best possible light for their bosses. That's what they are. They're mouthpieces for the president. But Karine Jean-Pierre is truly next level. So there have been all these videos that we have seen, multiple videos of Joe Biden's age showing, of him seeming lost, squatting down weird at the D-Day celebration. I mean, we just saw the video of Biden him in Los Angeles where Barack Obama had to like lead him off by his hand. Well, Karine Jean-Pierre says we're all just making that up.
There were two instances in recent days where leaders, former President Obama and George Maloney of Italy, they physically put hands on the president to guide him and show him, give stage directions. Are they doing that on their own, or has anybody asked them to run the show like that?
First of all, let me spoke to the most recent, right? And as we saw on Saturday, President Obama's office put out a statement. So I would refer you to that statement about what was being accused in those by others. And he said this did not happen in the sense of what people were saying they were seeing, right? Or what was being falsely reported that they were seeing. Let's not forget, President Obama, President Biden have a relationship. They are friends. They're like family to each other. And I think that's what you saw. You saw the president put his hand on the back of President Biden, and they walked off the stage after taking questions at an event, taking questions from Jimmy Kimmel. That is what you saw.
Man, that is word soup. I don't even know. It's so spastic. But I also love how in there she's saying, Obama's people released a statement about what people said they were seeing. It's like, no, people saw what they saw, right? And they saw an old man who looked very confused and had to be grabbed by the wrist and led off stage by a former president of the United States. And, you know, there's context here, right? That didn't happen on an island. I think if that were the only instance of Biden looking dazed and confused, then that would be a different scenario, but there have been, especially in recent months, video after video after video. And Karine Jean-Pierre says that these videos are, I don't even know what this phrase means, not deep fakes, cheap fakes.
Instead of talking about the president's performance in office, and what I mean by that is his legislative wins, what he's been able to do for the American people across the country, we're seeing these deep fakes, these manipulated videos. And it is, again, done in bad faith.
Wait, so she did call them deep fakes? I thought she called them cheap fakes.
I think
fakes.
She calls them both. I think earlier.
Sorry, I was thinking about a different clip. But she went off and off and off on that. And then she was going, no, they're cheap fakes. That's the first I've heard anyone suggest, because deepfakes is a serious thing. Deepfakes means that that is not something that President Biden did, right? That is a manipulated video, like with AI, when we know that's not the case. In which ones are she saying are deepfakes? I'm not saying there's never been deepfakes out there of President Biden on the internet, but the videos in France...
That's not manipulated.
It was on every news outlet. Like, it was straight. It was live. It happened live. A lot of the networks carried it live. There are multiple videos that show him wandering around on stage and being let off by Obama. That's not fake. When he was at that celebration and he's like weird squatting and his wife leads him out, that's not fake. So I don't know what she's talking about. And it's like a, you know, she's probably found like one deep fake on the internet that 10 people saw. And she's like, oh, these videos are deep fakes. Okay, maybe that one is. But, you know, what are we supposed to not believe our lying eyes? So it's stunning to me that the Democratic Party and the White House continues to believe that it can convince regular Americans that we're not seeing what we're seeing with our own eyes. I talked to a friend of mine, I won't name names, who's going to vote for Biden in November if the choice is between Trump and Biden. But that friend was still deeply concerned about, like, clearly Joe Biden seems like he does not have long left. How do I put that? I don't want to, like, I'm not wishing. The clock is ticking. He's clearly not doing well mentally. And so here I have this friend who's like fully aware of that, how scary it is and how the videos are just outrageous. And it's like, people who even support him see it. So Karine Jean-Pierre, it bothers me to the core when you have mouthpieces for politicians who are paid with taxpayer money, who that's what they get to do. We pay them to manipulate the truth, to lie to our faces, to tell us what we're seeing is not actually what we're seeing. It's unreal. Unreal. Okay, if you are close to retirement, saving for retirement, which I hope every single one of you are, I know that there's an unpredictability to the market right now. You've got the election coming up, global unrest, weird market volatility. And you also have this issue of inflation. Where is the retirement that you have envisioned? Is inflation going to take that away from you? And you've saved X amount of money. Is it going to go as far as you thought it was going to go? So Zach Abraham and Bulwark Capital, they're having one of their free Know Your Risk webinars coming up on the 27th at 3:30 p.m. It's totally virtual. It doesn't cost anything. There's no obligation. But they're going to focus this specifically on inflation. They call it the silent portfolio killer, and kind of walk you through how you know whether what you're saving is going to keep up with these insane inflationary rates that we're seeing in this environment right now. So don't miss Zach's special inflation webinar, June 27th at 3:30 p.m. Pacific time. You can sign up right now, knowyourriskradio.com. It's free and it's easy. You just go to that website and it pops up on your screen and you can register there. So knowyourriskradio.com. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance doesn't guarantee future results. Trek 24244. Go to knowyourriskradio.com. Okay, questions and comments on Chief Adrian Diaz, former Chief Adrian Diaz, coming out as gay and also saying that he's interviewing for the Austin police chief job. So maybe that was a way to just like, let's just get this out there right now.
Isn't that weird though? Would you tell somebody that you're applying for a job and you're up for chief? I mean, they do when they announce the you know, the final candidates. I know I've seen that, but it's really odd, I think, really early on in the search to.
And maybe this is also about like, hey, let me get this out there because it's kind of with all this scandal going on, I don't think Austin PD would consider a candidate like that, but maybe he's hoping that this helps ease those concerns a little bit. I'm not sure. Brett says the left will hate him because he's a cop no matter what. Oh, 100%. It's so funny how they're like, Pride Month, yay, gay people. But screw you, Adrian Diaz. You're lying just to like get out of a lawsuit. It's weird. Matthew Cook on Dow Constantine. When you lie so frequently, it's hard to keep track of all your BS. Yeah, yeah, that's true. Sergeant Pickles, they say it's about affordable housing, but they are the ones who made building homes massively more expensive. Make it make sense. Yeah, we talked to RHA about this. We talked to BIAW, the Building Industry Association of Washington, about this all the time. Look at the natural gas, the efforts to ban natural gas, which will cost homeowners tens of thousands of dollars if they have to electrify their homes. If they're having to electrify a home that they rent out, who do you think is going to bear the burden of that? Well, they're going to raise rents, right? And then you also look at all these building codes and standards that have come down under Jay Inslee and his building code council that have increased the cost of building homes tens of thousands of dollars. And then you've got permitting delays. You know, for every week that you've got a permitting delay, it increased costs for builders and it increased the cost of the home. This stuff is not rocket science. You cannot build affordable housing if housing isn't affordable to build. So that's what they've done. It's like, oh, this is a housing crisis. Okay, where have you been for 15 years, Dow Constantine? Where have you been for 12 years, Jay Inslee? Where have you been for the last 40 years, Democratic Party, that has had control for the vast majority of that time? So that's first and foremost. And also, are you willing to acknowledge some of the things that you're doing that are making housing less affordable while you're talking out of both sides of your mouth? Todd Welch, King County residents are leaving due to crime, taxes, and overregulation. Many East King County residents are running to Snohomish County to live more affordably due to taxes. But for how long? Snohomish County, a lot of what has happened in Seattle is it's finding its way into Snohomish County, into Pierce County, Snohomish County more so, I think, than Pierce County. But, you know, all if we don't stop things in its tracks right now, King County, this stuff isn't going to stay in King County. It's already starting to find its way out. And really what you see are King County and Seattle policies that then make their way to Olympia. And now the brand of Democrats in control in Olympia are Seattle Democrats, which are much different than like Spokane Democrats, for instance. So those are the people who are in power. If we don't do something about it now, we are screwed. On COVID and being urged to wear masks again, Cat F, with all the people coming into the country illegally, I'm more concerned about communicable diseases. Yeah, and do you think they're still testing them? It was like when they were letting people pour across the border during the COVID-19 pandemic. Mm-hmm. We couldn't leave our homes. I couldn't go into a tiny restaurant without wearing a mask, and you were letting people pour across the southern border by the tens of thousands and not checking them for anything? Like, give me a freaking break. On Queen Jean-Pierre, Jeremy Hubble says, I don't know how that woman does her job with a straight face. I don't know how the reporters sit in there and watch her do her job with a straight face. It's insane. And I'm not saying there weren't some bad press secretaries under Trump. Obama's was fine. You didn't have this level of, I think, true gaslighting.
Right.
Brent Davis with a $4.99 super chat. Brandy, why shouldn't we be concerned when it comes to Dave Reichert's voting record, including him voting yes on cap and trade? Yeah, it's something, I mean, I'll have Dave Reichert in before the primary to talk to him about some of the concerns that more conservative voters have about things that he's voted for or against that didn't line up with the Republican Party. One of them is a old vote on cap and trade. I think there's something, when I have looked into it, much different about that program federally versus on a state level, certainly. So I'm not saying, by the way, that you shouldn't be concerned about or look into someone's voting record. I mean, a voting record tells you a lot about a politician and what kind of politician they'll be in the next office that they seek. The case I've made for Dave Reichert isn't that he is some like pure Republican. I don't care if he's a pure Republican. I'm not a Republican. I like that he has thought independently. I like that he has sometimes gone against the grain of his own political party. And I think that makes him more electable in a blue state that hasn't elected a Republican governor in 40 years. It's this weird desire, I think, from some on the right to have a very staunch conservative candidate. Okay, like Lauren Kolb, who lost by 500,000 votes. So you can have what you deem to be an ideologically pure Republican candidate. They'll never step foot in the governor's office. So if you don't care if that's more important to have a candidate that aligns with you 100% of the time or near 100% of the time than to have a candidate who can actually win, that's fine. I just think that that happens to be a really bad idea. Like, no, you're not going to go from blue for 40 years to deep, dark red. You can maybe go from blue to like a little bit of purple, get it in there, show them that purple's not so bad, and then maybe you get into red, and then you're like, yeah, this is actually working for us. We like these policies. But to go from one to the other in a year, like, that's not going to happen. You guys, that's not going to happen. Like, can we stop pretending that it's going to happen? It's just, Dave is hard enough. Dave didn't even get the Republican Party endorsement, is fiercely independent-minded, really doesn't care what his party thinks of him, which I like, and it's still going to be hard for him to win. So, no, I'm not saying don't be concerned about his voting record, but don't, like, be blinded by a couple things you disagree with him about, so much so that you support a candidate who has no chance of winning and can't win the overall electorate. Sure, they can get 72% of support from party loyalists at a convention, but if Republican Party loyalists determined who was in the governor's office, we certainly wouldn't have a Governor Jay Inslee for three terms. You feel what I'm, you get what I'm selling you? You feel this? Okay. Great. Carlene Heath, I missed yesterday's live show because I took my Nana grocery shopping for the first time in about 5 years. She couldn't believe the prices since it had been so long since she's been to the store. That probably would be sticker shock. Like, I mean, mm-hmm. I told you, Mike is like, I'm not going to QFC anymore. He's like, I'm going to Costco. I'm getting my like bulk Costco meals. Then he'll cook them and then he'll mm-hmm. make his little packaged meals and then he'll freeze them. So, and like, we do okay. You know, we're not wanting for anything. But I think when you start to notice, you're like, yeah, same stuff for way more. That's ridiculous.
And some of the prices are just crazy. I mean,
eggs.
This is, yeah, eggs. Yeah. But this is a silly one, but I bought rice cakes. Those are $5. I know. I'm trying to watch my snacking, all right?
You deserve to pay $5 calorie for rice cakes. That's disgusting. That should be a punishment. You know, they do a sin tax on like cigarettes and booze and stuff. There should be a nasty
ranch flavor.
There should be a nasty tax on rice cakes. That's gross.
They're delicious.
Oh, man. Anyway. I just disagree. Noreen Beryl Anderson says, took 2066, initiative 2066 to work today, filled in a few hours. Hard to believe how many have no idea that this is happening in the state. Good for you. Thank you for doing that.
It is hard to believe, by the way.
It really is. There are people who are living their oblivious, nice, calm lives.
But you know
lives
why? Because we're the only ones talking about it to the extent that we are. I mean, it's got a couple mentions in the media, but really nobody's... I mean, you have to follow people. You have to talk to your neighbor. You have to talk to your friends about these things because otherwise they just fall flat unless you're really consuming this kind of news and news on a daily basis.
So. Yeah. Yep. I totally agree.
Get it out there. Tell people. Don't assume.
Let's see. Brent responded to my Dave Reichert rant. He said, moral consistency, eh? I think you're talking to me. My position on Dave has nothing to do with moral consistency. I am not saying that you cannot support a candidate who you are more ideologically aligned with. That makes sense, right? I'm just saying that you have to understand that you might be doing it at the expense of a candidate who can win. So you're looking at, can I get a candidate who agrees with 60% of what I want or 0%? Because that's kind of the choice, right? If you're a staunch Republican and you see a couple votes that Dave Reichert took that you're not morally aligned with, like, yeah, I'm not saying that that shouldn't bother you or raise concerns for you. But like, is that worse than Bob Ferguson? I hope that you don't see that as worse than Bob Ferguson. And Dave Reichert also isn't pretending to be a Republican Party loyalist. He's not. I mean, he did what a lot of politicians do, and you just pick a party. But honestly, Dave Reichert and Mark Mullett, I wish both of them had run as independents because you see this disaster and dysfunction in both the political parties. I don't think it's doing anything for either of them to be associated with the political parties. So I would just say, you know, cut the tie.
Strings.
Let go of the teat. Whatever it is.
Okay.
Apparently I can't, all my sayings are sexual. Apparently I can't say circle jerk on my show anymore because everybody thinks it's the sexual definition.
Eh.
Nicole's like, you can say it. Thanks, Nicole.
It's funny to me that people don't see the strategy. I think you have to have strategy.
Right.
All of these campaigns, I mean, sometimes we criticize our strategy because it's dumb, mm-hmm. but just in general, if you want Sammy Burt, you know he can't win. What's your strategy there?
Right.
What is that going to do for you? You know he can't win.
Like, so just kind of.
What's it going to do?
I almost think it's just, it's their way of revolting against frustration. Like, let's talk about this for a minute.
So
do we have any tapings
better?
Coming up?
No.
Do we have tapings? Okay, we're fine to go over. Let's talk about this, right? I get it that it's hard to vote for a candidate that you're not super passionate about, right? Mm-hmm. But how often do we get candidates that we're super passionate about? Look at the presidential election. I mean, some people might be super passionate about Trump or whatever, but is any Democrat super passionate about Biden? No, but they're going to choose him because they don't like Trump or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. I think when we pick political candidate, the only political candidate who's going to agree with you 100% of the time is you. If you want a political candidate who agrees with you 100% of the time, you have to run for public office. And then you'll get it because it'll be you, right? So you're never going to have some sort of like absolute 100% alignment. But also, I think that there is, to give them a little bit of a benefit of the doubt, the semi-bird crowd. I understand how staunch Republicans, staunch conservatives, I understand how they are probably very, very frustrated and saddened with the state of things. Mm-hmm. I get it. You've done a lot of losing. We've had a lot of candidates who are in control, who you are night and day with ideologically, and they are interfering with your happiness and your life and your family and all of that, your freedoms and your liberties. I'm pissed off too. I'm mad too. And so I think there's a lot of rightful, deep-seated anger at what the state has become. And I think supporting someone like Semi Byrd, who talks a lot about the Constitution and all these things, I think that they see someone who gets them. I think they see someone who gets them and who they feel like is going to fight harder against the political party, the class in Washington of Democrats, who've put them in this position of being so upset right. and so enraged. And so I understand. I get it. But you also have to be realistic and look at the political makeup of our state. There's a reason why we haven't elected a Republican governor in 40 years. There's a reason why Democrats have had complete control for the last 8 legislative sessions and much of the last 24 legislative sessions in Olympia. It's because, whether you like it or not, and I know sometimes it's hard to believe, more people in this state vote for Democrats than vote for Republicans. There's a reason it's a blue state. It's not a purple state. Certainly not a red state. It's a blue state. And yes, a lot of that is focused on King County. So that's what we have to contend with, right? So how do we turn a blue state into a red state? I don't think you do it overnight.
You go purple
you
first.
You go purple first, and you expose people to the types of ideas that Republicans have put forth for dealing with the unaffordability crisis, the homeless crisis, the drug crisis, the crime. And you try to convince them that there is a better way. There is a more sane way. And I really think the only way you can do that, I know it's hard. I know it's hard to accept that. You can't snap your fingers and change things overnight, but you can do it little by little. And what I see in Dave Reichert is someone who was already at the end of his political career, had no intention of running for something else, and said, look, I can either retire in Chelan, or I know I'm in a position to maybe be able to win, so I'm going to try to do something. Take all the heat he's taking from his own party for not being pure enough, despite, you know, the fact that for 30 years he served with distinction and had no issues and nothing that came up about him. And he's in a position for 4 years, 8 if he chooses, to be able to say, let's just take a break. Let's take a break. We've been on this track for 40 years. Let's take a little break, a little pause, time out, and let's stop the crazy first, and then let's figure out how to start to fix things. But I think right now what we need is a break, a pause, to stop the crazy, and then move on from there. Mm-hmm. So that's what I see Dave Reichert as being, is like this buffer between crazy and convincing people that we can go down a better path. And maybe in 40 years, there is a time and a place for a candidate like, with the beliefs of Semi Byrd, maybe not the baggage, but a candidate with the beliefs of Semi Byrd to be the governor of Washington. But you have to do the work and put in the steps to get there. So that's the point that I'm making.
I think that sometimes people compare it to the United States and the Trump situation, and it's not the same. No. Washington is not the same as the United States, no. which has had many Republican presidents. It's not the same.
Right. And you have swing states and all that. We're not a swing state.
No.
We are not a swing state. No matter what the polls tell you, we're not a swing state. We're a blue state. We have to start acting like it. You have to start acting like you're a blue state and having candidates who can appeal to a blue voting base, to a purple voting base. Really, you're talking about maybe reaching 200,000 voters and convincing them to vote for a Republican candidate for governor. So that's the task. Like, let's not get distracted with purity demands and all of this. Let's focus on the task. The task is finding someone who convince enough Republicans, who convince enough Democrats and independents to vote for them. And that person is going to have to be someone with a reputation of being independent-minded. All right. Wow. A lot of... got completely carried away. What's next? Oh, our closing sanity check. Okay, thank you. All right. if you know anything about me, it's that I'm strictly anti-union. No, that's not true. I come and go on the union issue. You know, definitely a difference between private sector and public sector unions and how I view them. However, it was just really fascinating. We watched this play out in the Seattle area with efforts to unionize Starbucks locations. And whenever Starbucks would, Starbucks is union busting. They don't want us to join a union. Despite the fact that Starbucks pays its baristas like more than $20 an hour and also gives them free tuition and all these things, not good enough. So anyway, in Philadelphia, some coffee shop employees voted to unionize, and the result was quite predictable.
Ori, you can't hide. We all see your greedy side.
Former employees of OCF Coffee House rallied outside of the now closed Fairmount Cafe on Tuesday.
We've been paid really bad wages, and this was our attempt to get better wages and like make the place that we love better.
The coffee shops are owned by OCF Realty. The real estate brokerage announced the closures to employees in an email, which included two other locations in South Philly. Workers like Alex Simpson say they were shocked.
I am pretty crushed, especially when it's such a blatant response to our union process. Like, this comes a week after we publicly announced our union.
F around and find out. Yeah, coffee shop baristas vote to unionize a week later. The coffee shop says, okay, well, now you're all out of jobs because we're closing our doors. That has been your sanity check for today. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving Common Sense a comeback. We appreciate every single one of you. If you have not signed up to support our show already, you can do so for just $5 a month. Go to UndividedPod.com, UndividedPod.com, and while you're there, shop our merch store. Get some of our Common Sense 2024 swag to display to your friends. Tell them how sane you are compared to them. UndividedPod.com. We'll see you back here on the live show tomorrow at noon.